Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Heart of the Machine, Our Future in a World of Artificial Emotional Intelligence, by Richard Yonk, narrated by Robertson Dean. Introduction. Emotion. It's as central to who you are as your body and your intellect. While most of us know emotion when we see or experience it, many questions remain about what it is, how it functions, and even why it exists in the first place. What's known for certain is that without it, you would not be the person you are today. Now, we find ourselves entering an astonishing new era, an era in which we are beginning to imbue our technologies with the ability to read, interpret, replicate, and potentially even experience emotions themselves. This is being made possible by a relatively new branch of artificial intelligence known as affective computing. A powerful and remarkable technology, affective computing is destined to transform our lives and our world over the coming decades. To some, this may all sound like science fiction, while to others, it is simply another example of the relentless march of progress. Either way, we are growing closer to our technology than ever before. Ultimately, this will lead to our devices becoming our assistants, our friends and companions, and yes, possibly, even our lovers. In the course of it all, we may even see the dream, or nightmare, of truly intelligent machines come true. From the moment culture and tool-making began, the history and evolution of humanity and technology have been deeply intertwined. Neither humans nor machines would be anywhere close to what we are today without the immediate and ongoing aid of the other. This is an inextricable trend that, with luck, will continue for our world's remaining lifespan and beyond. This technological evolution is being driven by social and economic forces that mimic some of the processes of natural selection, though certainly not all of them. In an effort to attain competitive advantage, humans use technologies, including machines, institutions, and culture. In turn, these pass through a series of filters that determine a given technology's fitness within its overall environment. That environment, which blends society's physical, social, economic, and political realities, decides the success of each new development, even as it is modified and supported by every further advance. Though natural and technological evolution share some similarities, one way they differ is in the exponential nature of technological change. While biology evolves at a relatively steady, linear pace that is dictated by factors such as metabolism, replication rates, and the frequency of nucleotide mutation, technological evolution functions within multiple positive feedback loops that actually accelerate its development. Though this acceleration is not completely constant and typically levels off for any single domain or paradigm, over time and across the entire technological landscape, the trend results in a net positive increase in knowledge and capabilities. Because of this, technology and all it makes possible advances at an ever-increasing exponential rate, far outpacing the changes seen in the biological world over the same period. One of the consequences of all this progress is that it generates a need to create increasingly sophisticated user interfaces that allow us to control and interact with our many new devices and technologies. This is certainly borne out in my own experience developing interfaces for computer applications over many years. As technology theorist Brenda Laurel observed, the greater the difference between the two entities, the greater the need for a well-designed interface. As a result, one ongoing trend is that we continue to develop interfaces that are increasingly natural to use, integrating them ever more closely with our lives and our bodies, our hearts, and our minds. Heart of the Machine is about some of the newest of these natural interfaces. Affective computing integrates computer science, artificial intelligence, robotics, cognitive science, psychology, biometrics, and much more in order to allow us to communicate and interact with computers, robots, and other technologies via our feelings. These systems are being designed to read, interpret, replicate, and potentially even influence human emotions. Already, some of these applications have moved out of the lab and into commercial use. All of this marks a new era, one in which we're seeing the digitization of affect, a term psychologists and cognitive scientists use to refer to the display of emotion. While this is a very significant step in our increasingly high-tech world, it isn't an entirely unanticipated one. As you'll see, this is a development that makes perfect sense in terms of our ongoing, evolving relationship with technology. At the same time, it's bringing about a shift in that relationship that will have tremendous repercussions for both man and machine. The path it takes us down is far from certain. The world it could lead to may be a better place, or it might be a far worse one. Will these developments yield systems that anticipate and fulfill our every need before we're even aware of them? Or will they give rise to machines that can be used to stealthily manipulate us as individuals, perhaps even en masse? Either way, it's in our best interests to explore the possible futures this technology could bring about while we still have time to influence how these will ultimately manifest. In the course of this book, multiple perspectives will be taken at different points. This is entirely intentional. When exploring the future, recognizing that it can't truly be known or predicted is critical. One of the best ways of addressing this is to explore numerous possible future scenarios and, within reason, prepare for such. This means not only considering what happens if the technology develops as planned or not, but also whether people will embrace it or resist it. It means anticipating the short, mid, and long-term repercussions that may arise from it, including what would otherwise be unforeseen consequences. This futurist's view can help us to prepare for a range of eventualities, taking a provocative approach in directing how our future develops. Heart of the Machine is divided into three sections. The first, The Road to Affective Computing, introduces our emotional world, from humanity's earliest days up to the initial development of emotionally aware affective computers and social robots. The second section, The Rise of the Emotional Machines, looks at the many ways these technologies are being applied, how we'll benefit from them, and what we should be worried about as they meet their future potential. Finally, The Future of Artificial Emotional Intelligence explores the big questions about how all of this is likely to develop and the effects it will have on us as individuals and as a society. It wraps up with a number of thoughts about consciousness and superintelligence, and considers how these developments may alter the balance of the human-machine relationship. Until now, our 3-million-year journey with technology has been a relatively one-sided and perpetually mute one. But how might this change once we begin interacting with machines on what for us remains such a basic level of experience? At the same time, are we priming technology for some sort of giant leap forward with these advances? If artificial intelligence is ever to attain or exceed human levels, and perhaps even achieve consciousness in the process, will feelings and all they make possible be the spark that lights the fuse? Only time will tell, but in the meantime, we'd be wise to explore the possibility. Though this is a book about emotions and feelings, it is very much founded on science, research, and an appreciation of the evolving nature of intelligence in the universe. As we'll explore, emotions may be not only a key aspect of our own humanity, but a crucial component for many, if not all, higher intelligences, no matter what form these may eventually take. A Futurist View. Futures, or strategic foresight, as it's sometimes known, is a field unlike any other. On any given day, you're likely to be asked, what is a futurist, or what does a futurist do? Many people have an image of a fortune teller gazing into a crystal ball, but nothing could be further from the truth, because ultimately, all of us are futurists. Foresight is one of the dominant characteristics of the human species. With self-awareness and introspection came the ability to anticipate patterns and cycles in our environment, enhancing our ability to survive. As a result, we've evolved a prefrontal cortex that enables us to think about the days ahead far better than any other species. It might have begun with something like the recognition of shifting patterns in the grasslands of the Serengeti that let us know a predator lay in wait. This continued as we began to distinguish the phases of the moon, the ebb and flow of the tides, the cycles of the seasons. Then it wasn't long before we were anticipating eclipses, forecasting hurricanes, and predicting stock market crashes. We are Homo sapiens, the futurist species. Of course, this was only the beginning. As incredible as this ability of ours is, it could only do so much in its original unstructured state. So, when the world began asking itself some very difficult and important existential questions about surviving the nuclear era, it was time to begin formalizing how we thought about the future. For many, Project RAND, which began immediately after World War II, marks the beginning of the formal foresight process. Building on our existing capabilities, Project RAND sought to understand the needs and benefits of connecting military planning with R&D decisions. This allowed the military to better understand not only what its future capabilities would be, but also those of the enemy. This was critical because, being the dawn of the atomic age, there were enormous uncertainties about our future, including whether or not we would actually survive to have one. Project RAND eventually transformed into the RAND Corporation, one of the first global policy think tanks. As the space race ramped up, interest in foresight grew, particularly in government and the military. In time, corporations began showing interest too, as was famously demonstrated by Royal Dutch Shell's application of scenarios in response to the 1973 oil crisis. Tools and methods have continued to be developed until today, and many of the processes of foresight are used throughout our world, from corporations like Intel and Microsoft, who have in-house futurists, to smaller businesses and organizations that hire consulting futurists. Branding, product design, research and development, government planning, education administration, if it has a future, there are people who explore it. Using techniques for framing projects, scanning for and gathering information, building forecasts and scenarios, creating visions and planning and implementing them, these practitioners help identify opportunities and challenges so that we can work toward our preferred future. This is an important aspect of foresight work. Recognizing the future is not set in stone and that we will all have some ability to influence how it develops. Notice I say influence, not control. The many elements that make up the future are of a scale and complexity far too great for any of us to control. But if we recognize something about our future that we want to manifest, and we recognize it early enough, we can influence other factors that will increase its likelihood of being realized. A great personal example would be saving for retirement. A young person who recognizes they will one day retire can start building their savings and investments early on. In doing this, they're more likely to be financially secure in their golden years, much more so than if they'd waited until they were in their 50s or 60s before they started saving. Many of foresight's methods and processes have been used in the course of writing this book. Horizon scanning, surveying of experts, and trend projections are just a few of these. Scenarios are probably the most evident of these tools because they're included throughout the book. The processes futurists use generate a lot of data, which often doesn't convey what's important to us as people. But telling stories does, because we've been storytellers from the very beginning. Stories help us to relate to new knowledge and to each other. This is what a scenario does. It takes all of that data and transforms it into a more personal form that is easier for us to digest. Forecasts are more generally included because in many respects they're not that valuable. Some people think studying the future is about making predictions, which really isn't the case. Knowing whether an event will happen in 2023 or 2026 is of limited value compared with the act of anticipating the event at all and then deciding what we're going to do about it. Speculating about who's going to win a horse race or the World Cup is for gamblers, not for futurists. In many respects, a futurist explores the future the way a historian explores history, inferring a whole picture or pattern from fragments of clues. While it may be tempting to ask how there can be clues to something that hasn't even happened yet, recall that every future is founded upon the past and present, and that these are laden with signals and indicators of what's to come. So read on and learn about this future age of artificial emotional intelligence, because all too soon it will be part of our present as well. Part 1. The Road to Effective Computing. Chapter 1. The Dawn of Emotional Machines. Menlo Park, California, March 3, 2032, 7:06 a.m. It's a damp spring morning as Abigail is gently roused from slumber by Mandy, her personal digital assistant. Sensors in the bed inform Mandy exactly where Abigail is in her sleep cycle, allowing it to coordinate with her work schedule and wake her at the optimum time. Given the morning's gray skies and Abigail's less than cheery mood when she went to bed the night before, Mandy opts to waken her with a recorded dawn chorus of sparrows and goldfinches. Abigail stretches and sits up on the edge of the bed, feeling for her slippers with her feet. Morning already? She mutters. You slept 7 hours and 19 minutes with minimal interruption, Mandy informs her with a pleasant, algorithmically defined lilt via the room's concealed speaker system. How are you feeling this morning?
Good,
Abigail replies, blinking. Great, actually. It's a pleasantry. Mandy didn't really need to ask or to hear its owner's response. The digital assistant had already analyzed Abigail's posture, energy levels, expression, and vocal tone using its many remote sensors, assessing that her mood is much improved from the prior evening. It's a routine morning for the young woman and her technology. The two have been together for a long time. Many years before, when she was still a teen, Abigail named her assistant Mandy. Of course, back then, the software was also several versions less sophisticated than it is today, so, in a sense, they've grown up together. During that time, Mandy has become increasingly familiar with Abigail's work habits, behavioral patterns, moods, preferences, and various other idiosyncrasies. In many ways, it knows Abigail better than any person ever could. Mandy proceeds to tell Abigail about the weather and traffic conditions, her morning work schedule, and a few of the more juicy items rising to the top of her social media stream as she gets ready for her day.
Mandy, Abigail asks as she brushes her hair, do you have everything organized for today's board meeting?
The personal assistant has already anticipated the question and consulted Abigail's calendar and biometric historical data before making all the needed preparations for her meeting with her board of directors. As the CEO of AAT, Applied Affective Technologies, Abigail and her company are at the forefront of human-machine relations.
Everyone's received their copies of the meeting agenda. Your notes and 3D presentation are finalized. Jeremy has the breakfast catering covered, and I picked out your clothes for the day, the Nina Ricci set.
Didn't I wear that recently?
Mandy responds without hesitation.
My records show you last wore it over 2 months ago for a similarly important meeting. It made you feel confident and empowered, and none of today's attendees has seen it on you before.
Perfect, Abigail beams.
Mandy, what would I do without you?
What indeed? Though this scenario may sound like something from a science fiction novel, in fact, it's a relatively reasonable extrapolation of where technology could be 15 years from now. Already, voice recognition and synthesis, the real-time measurement of personal biometrics, and artificially intelligent scheduling systems are becoming an increasing part of our daily lives. Given continuing improvements in computing power, as well as advances in other relevant technologies, in a mere decade, these tools will be far more advanced than they are today. However, the truly transformational changes described here will come from a branch of computer science that is still very much in its nascent stages, still early enough that many people have yet to even hear about it. It's called affective computing, and it deals with the development of systems and devices that interact with our feelings. More specifically, affective computing involves the recognition, interpretation, replication, and potentially the manipulation of human emotions by computers and social robots.
This rapidly developing field has the potential to radically change the way we interact with our computers and other devices. Increasingly, systems and controls will be able to alter their operations and behavior according to our emotional responses and other nonverbal cues. By doing this, our technology will become increasingly intuitive to use, addressing not only our explicit commands, but our unspoken needs as well. In the pages that follow, we will explore just what this new era could mean for our technologies and for ourselves. We are all emotional machines. Centuries of research into anatomy, biology, neurology, and numerous other fields has consistently revealed that nearly all of what we are follows a predictable set of physical processes. These mechanistically driven rules make it possible for us to move, to eat, to grow, to procreate. Within an extremely small range of genetic variation, we are all essentially copies of those who came before us, destined to produce generation after generation of nearly identical cookie-cutter reproductions of ourselves well into the future. Of course, we know this is far from the true reality of the human experience. Though these deterministic forces define us up to a point, we exist in far greater depth and dimension than can be explained by any mere set of stimuli and responses. This is foremost because we are emotional beings. That the dreams, hopes, fears, and desires of each and every one of us are so unique while remaining so universal is largely due to our emotional experience of the world. If this were not so, identical twins who grow up together would have all but identical personalities. Instead, they begin with certain shared genetically influenced traits and behaviors, and over time diverge from there. While all humanity shares nearly identical biology, chemical processes, and modes of sensory input, it is our feelings, our emotional interpretations of and responses to the world we experience that makes all of us on this planet, all 107 billion people who have ever lived, truly unique from one another. There are easily hundreds, if not thousands, of theories about emotions, what they are, why they exist, and how they came about, and there is no way for a book such as this to begin to introduce or address them all. Nor does this book claim to know which, if any, of these is the one true theory, in part because, in all likelihood, there is none. It's been said repeatedly by neuroscientists, psychologists, and philosophers that there are nearly as many theories of emotion as there are theorists. Emotion is an incredibly complex aspect of the human condition and mind, second only perhaps to the mystery of consciousness itself. What is important is to recognize its depth and complexity without attempting to oversimplify either its mechanisms or purpose. Emotions are one of the most fundamental components of the human experience. Yet, as central as they are to our lives, we continue to find it a challenge to define or even to account for them. In many respects, we seem to have our greatest insights about feelings and emotions in their absence, or when they go awry. Despite the many theories that exist, all we know with certainty is that they are essential in making us who we are, and that without them, we would be but pale imitations of ourselves. So, what might this mean as we enter an era in which our machines, our computers, robots, and other devices, become increasingly capable of interacting with our emotions? How will it change our relationship with our technologies and with each other? How will it alter technology itself? Perhaps most importantly, if emotion has evolved in humans and certain other animals because it affords us some benefit, might it convey a similar benefit in the future development of artificial intelligence? For reasons that will be explored in the coming chapters, affective computing is a very natural progression in our ongoing efforts to build technologies that operate increasingly on human terms rather than the other way around. As a result, this branch of artificial intelligence will come to be incorporated to one degree or another nearly everywhere in our lives. At the same time, just like almost every other form of artificial intelligence that has been developed and commercialized, affective computing will eventually fade into the scenery, an overlooked, underappreciated feature that we will quickly take all too much for granted because it will be ubiquitous. Consider the possibilities. Rooms that alter lighting and music based on your mood. Toys that engage young minds with natural emotional responses. Computer programs that notice your frustration over a task and alter their manner of assistance. Email that makes you pause before sending that overly inflammatory message. The scenarios are virtually endless. But it's a rare technology that doesn't have unintended consequences, or that is used exclusively as its inventors anticipated. Affective computing will be no different. It doesn't take a huge leap of foresight to anticipate that this technology will also inevitably be applied and abused in ways that clearly aren't a benefit to the majority of society. As this book will explore, like so many other technologies, affective computing will come to be seen as a double-edged sword, one that is capable of working for us while also having the capacity to do us considerable harm. Amidst all of this radical progress, there is yet another story to be told. In many respects, affective computing represents a milestone in the long evolution of technology and our relationship to it. It's a story millions of years in the making, and one that may be approaching a critical juncture, one that could well determine not only the future of technology, but of the human race. But first, let's examine a question that is no doubt on many people's minds. Why would anyone want to do this? Why design devices that understand our feelings? As we'll see in the next chapter, it's a very natural, perhaps even inevitable step on a journey that began over 3 million years ago. Chapter 2. How Emotion Bootstrapped the First Technological Revolution. Gona Afar, Ethiopia, 3.39 million years ago. In a verdant gorge, a tiny, hirsute figure squats over a small pile of stones. Cupping one of these, a modest piece of chert, in her curled hand, she repeatedly hits the side of it with a second rock, a rounded piece of granite. Every few strikes, a flake flies from the chert, leaving behind it a concave depression. As the young woman works the stone, the previously amorphous mineral slowly takes shape, acquiring a sharp edge as the result of the laborious process. The work is half ritual, half legacy, a skill handed down from parent to child for untold generations. The end product, a small cutting tool, is capable of being firmly grasped and used to scrape meat from bones, ensuring that critical, life-sustaining morsels of food do not go to waste. Here in the great Rift Valley of East Africa, our Paleolithic ancestor is engaged in one of humanity's very earliest technologies. While her exact species remains unknown to us, she is certainly a bipedal hominid that preceded Homo habilis, the species long renowned in our textbooks as Handyman, the Toolmaker. Perhaps she is Kenyanthropus platyops, or the slightly larger Australopithecus afarensis. She is small by our standards, about 3.5 feet tall and relatively slender. Her brain case is also meager compared with our own, averaging about 400 cubic centimeters, less than a third of our 1,350 cubic centimeters. But then that's hardly a fair comparison. When judged against earlier branches of our family tree, this hominid, this early human, is a mental giant. She puts that prowess to good use, fashioning tools that set her species apart from all that have come before. While these stone tools might seem simple from today's perspective, at the time they were a tremendous leap forward, improving our ancestors' ability to obtain nutrition and to protect themselves from competitors and predators. These tools allowed them to slay beasts far more powerful than themselves and to scrape meat from bones. In turn, this altered their diet, providing much more regular access to the proteins and fats that would in time support further brain development. Making these tools required a knowledge and skill that combined our ancestors' considerably greater brain power with the manual dexterity granted by their opposable thumbs. But perhaps most important of all was developing the ability to communicate the knowledge of stone toolmaking, knapping as it's now known, which allowed this technology to be passed down from generation to generation.
This is all the more amazing because these hominids didn't rely on verbal language so much as on emotion, expressiveness, and other forms of nonverbal communication.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?